Good afternoon. Welcome to the final press conference for 2015. As you will have seen, I've made some changes to Cabinet. Tim Grosser has been appointed New Zealand's ambassador to Washington and will take up the post early in 2016. Tim will resign from Cabinet on the 14th of December. He'll be replaced in Parliament by Maureen Pugh from the West Coast. I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate Tim on his appointment. His experience in the trade portfolio, including successful conclusions of the TPP negotiations, make him an ideal person to represent our country's interests in Washington. On a personal note, Tim will be missed. He's been a valued colleague since arriving in Parliament in 2005 and has made a significant contribution to New Zealand's interests. Judith Collins will rejoin Cabinet, taking up the police and corrections portfolios. Judith's been a competent minister and will quickly be able to pick up the police and corrections portfolios that she has successfully held before. In other changes, Paula Bennett picks up climate change issues, a portfolio from Tim Grosser. Todd McClay becomes Minister of Trade. He retains his responsibilities for state-owned enterprises while handing over the revenue portfolio to Michael Woodhouse. Having picked up the revenue portfolio, Michael Woodhouse hands police to Judith Collins. Sam Lotta-Inger picks up the local government portfolio from Paula Bennett while handing corrections to Judith Collins. These changes will take effect on the 14th of December. I offered ACT leader David Seymour the positions of Minister for Regulatory Reform and Associate Minister of Education, but he declined my offer as he wants to see through his members' bill on end-of-life choice. He's also focused on continuing to rebuild the ACT Party and working hard as the new MP for Epsom. I respect his decision and look forward to continuing the close working relationship that we have with him in the current roles. On another note, you'll recall that at the start of the year I announced we want to improve the supply of social housing for New Zealanders in need. As part of this, we would offer around about 300 income-related rent subsidies to community housing providers in Auckland. You will have seen today that Paula Bennett has announced that the Ministry of Social Development will work with five registered community housing providers to deliver over 500 new social housing places over the next 3 years. This reflects stronger than expected interest and eagerness to innovate from community providers. Salvation Army has agreed to provide 87 extra places. Accessible Properties will provide 358 places, and the Chinese New Settler Trust will provide 36 places. It's good to have them all on board. Another two community providers are expected to sign up in the next few weeks, taking the number of new social housing places to over 500. This is more progress in our efforts to house more vulnerable New Zealanders. Just in terms of a wrap-up for what's been a pretty busy year for the government, our careful management of the books has seen us return to surplus and meant that we've been able to introduce new policies to support New Zealand families. These have included extending free doctor's visits and prescriptions to children aged under 13, extending paid parental leave, reducing ACC levies and increasing benefit payments. We've also helped thousands of New Zealanders into their first homes, and we've continued to invest heavily in health and education. We've surpassed 3 million tourists in a year for the first time, and we've announced one of the world's largest ocean sanctuaries around the Kermadec Islands. Kiwi families are benefiting from an economy which continues to grow, creating tens of thousands of new jobs and boosting incomes, and I look forward to another successful year in 2016. In the House this week, the government will focus on sending first readings to Select Committee before the House rises for Christmas. This includes the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill and the New Zealand Public Health and Disability Elections Bill. The House will rise, as you're aware, on Wednesday. In terms of my activities, I'm in Wellington tomorrow on Wednesday, I'm in Christchurch on Thursday, and Dunedin on Friday, which just leaves me to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. I'm sure you're looking forward to a break, I'm glad that I am, and we'll see you all in 2016. Questions?
Can I just ask you on a different subject? What's your level of concern at the moment about a homegrown style lone wolf terrorist attack?
Well, I can't rule that out simply because I don't think any country can. We live in a world now where ISIL has a very decentralised way of communicating with people and actually a very effective way. And we know that some of the people who are on that watch list of 40 people potentially could do undertake a domestic terror action. Now, as I've said in the past, I stand by this view. You know, while we're not immune from risk, I still genuinely believe we're a lower threat risk than a lot of other places in the world.
And how confident are you in the abilities of the SIS and the GCSB to thwart such an attack?
Where they can see information that they can legally access through the warranting process, then I think they can be highly effective. The concerns always are about dark communications, those that the agencies can't get access to, or people that we just simply don't pick up on the radar screen, either through the acts of their actions or the monitoring activities of, say, our international partners that might pick something up in the international cyberspace.
Do you think that the risk has increased because of New Zealand's involvement in Iraq?
I don't. I think, generally speaking, you've seen public comments in the past from ISIL that they've seen New Zealand as sort of the coalition of the West, if you like, anyway. So I don't think that's completely changed. And once we made the announcements to send the training troops to Iraq, you didn't see any particular noises out of ISIL that reflected that. I think that risk, in so much that it's there, has been there, you know, as long as ISIL's had a sort of view that they have, that westernised countries present a different worldview from them than they can share.
Prime Minister, Judith Collins' return, does she? You feel obviously she served her time on the back bench, she's paid for whatever price she's had to pay for the past, is that your view?
Yeah, look, I think if you look at the issues around Judith, she stood down as a minister just prior to the 2014 election on the basis of an email which characterised some behaviour, which if she had undertaken would have been very, very concerning indeed. In fact, actually, she was completely cleared of that through an independent inquiry. This has really been the first opportunity that I've had actually to potentially bring her back to cabinet, because with the movement of Tim Grosser to Washington, an opportunity presented itself. I think in that 12 months that she's been effectively on the back bench, she's had some time to reflect. I think she would say, like any politician actually, in life sometimes you do some things not as well as others, in particular instance that she stood down for, I think she's been completely cleared off. But you know, there are well documented other issues where she's probably had some time to reflect on those and learn from those experiences. And now, you know, I think as a minister, she'll do a good job. She did a good job as a minister prior to that. But as you're aware with one or two of the other issues, you know, she's probably learned a few experiences.
Do you think she'll be a better minister?
I always thought she was a very good minister, and I continue to think that. She has my absolute confidence. She didn't have one brought her back. And certainly in police and corrections, she was very well equipped to handle those portfolios and do a good job of them in the past. We know that there are plenty of challenges in front of those portfolios in the next couple of years. So, yes, I think she'll do a very good job as a minister.
Will you have another reshuffle next year?
I'm not planning that at this time. I don't think it's impossible that I do something more likely in early 2017. I mean, as we get into that election cycle, yeah, it's possible that you might see, for instance, some people announcing retirements. I'm not aware of it at the moment, but yeah, silly, you know, you can see that one or two people might consider that as an option. And if they did, then we may well want to have a slight refresh going into the 2017 election.
But was there any thought about keeping Grosser on going to assignment to the MP in February?
Yeah, well, what we did was we wanted to make sure he was here right through the process of getting TPP over the line, and that's effectively happened. From a New Zealand ratification perspective, it's going to go through a process here, but I don't think it's required that Tim would be here. And in essence, actually, his best work can really probably happen in Washington, where he'll work, you know, with congressmen and very much advocate for why TPP is a good thing, you know, both in New Zealand and the United States.
And why have you given climate change before the benefit of Simon Bridger?
Yeah, so I obviously considered that, and the advice I got from the Cabinet Office was that it was possible to have Simon Bridges as the Climate Change Minister, but there were quite a number of conflicts which would need to be managed. I personally thought, in principle, having him as Minister of Energy and as Minister of Climate Change was at least challenging as a conflict. And as you'll be aware, we've got a review that's going to be undertaken of the NTS. It is a
it is a portfolio that needs some of a good political nous and some dexterity. And actually, I thought Paul would bring that to the job. Simon could have done it if it wouldn't have been for the challenges, but I would have had to move energy.
Did you lose confidence in Sam Ottawa or in corrections?
No. To be blunt, I know that the way people will interpret it, but actually, my bigger issue was I wanted to make sure that the portfolios that Judith was picking up were the ones that I thought suited her natural areas. And it was I wanted to put police and corrections back together again. And so that was a more natural fit.
Why did you want them together again?
I was convinced of the view when I separated them that would work. But as a general rule, I had them together in the 8 to 11 period. And I actually think that worked pretty well. And I think actually 11 to 14 as well, I had them together. I mean, they are very much a natural fit within that wider justice portfolio, and I just think it makes sense to have them sitting alongside each other.
So
we
some disappointed back then,
yeah, well, I think as I said on TV this morning, you know, if you're not in cabinet, then you want to be there, and if you don't, you know, something wrong with you. I mean, most people want to be in cabinet, so yes, there will be. But, I mean, I think most people will respect the fact that Judith was the senior minister and a senior front bencher. And it's been my long-standing practice, as indeed probably was Helen Clark's actually, where people are cleared of an indiscretion that they should be allowed to return. There have been people that haven't returned to cabinet or have left cabinet because I felt that they've either run their course or their performance issues. But in the case of Judith, it was very much around that particular issue that she was cleared of.
Do you believe she can sort out the Serco mess?
Well, those challenges around the private provision of prisons and Serco on its contract and all those issues are going to be substantial challenges for her to deal with. There's no question she's got the capacity to do that. I do think it'll take a minister with a fair bit of experience and someone that can understand the balance the government's trying to achieve. Because one of the issues here is we are very committed to the private provision of both services and PPPs in terms of infrastructure. In fact, we probably make the case very strongly to you that Wiri's working well as a privately run prison, in this case run by Serco. There clearly have been challenges at Mount Eden. So she's going to have to walk that line of getting that right. I think on behalf of the government, I'm absolutely convinced she can.
She's going to have the car sponsorship?
Yeah, so I've obviously had those discussions, but she'll need to sit down with the cabinet office and work through any potential conflicts, as any minister does. But yes, the car sponsorship will go. She won't be writing for the Sunday Star Times, and she won't be on the Paul Henry show. I think she's going to do the show this week and the last wrap-up next week. I think she's done the last Sunday Star Times.
Some people might say that it looks a bit like you're bringing her into the tent because she was outside causing you trouble.
Yeah, but she resigned as a minister. Whatever it was, it was 2 weeks, wasn't it, prior to the general election. She felt very strongly she'd done absolutely nothing wrong, and the email in question had characterised behaviour that wasn't correct, and yet she kept her head down and worked hard in the local electorate. Over the course of the last 12 months, I don't think you can really point to areas where she's been overly critical of the government. She's got a strong view on some issues, but she's always had a strong view on things, and by the way, so do most of the other ministers. So I don't think that's right. I think she's tried to work hard to earn her way back into cabinet. She's ambitious, and I want ministers to be ambitious. No, there's no question mark over him. He's taking my advice to have a good recovery. As I said this morning, I mean, the operation he was originally having was much more straightforward surgery and turned out to be a lot more complex. It's great news that he's fit and healthy, but he's got a recovery period he's got to go through. He's got quite a challenging and punishing travel schedule for next year, and I was talking to him a bit about that when I returned from Berlin last week. But I'm very confident he'll be back on board before the House resumes effectively next year.
Was your decision to move local government from Port Bennett to Sam Ottawa any sort of signal about downgrading or changing the local government reform push?
No, Paul have done the work around local government, which I think we've acknowledged. You've had the Local Government Commission coming up some suggestions, as we saw in Nate Hastings. They failed to get public support. There is a pathway through, I think, to do more working with local government around shared services and
and potentially some amalgamations that they themselves recommend and suggest. And you know, Wellington's the sort of area where that's quite possible and on the cards. So we want that work to carry on. It's just really a matter of that. In Paula's case, we couldn't overload her with everything, and she has a social finance, which is a lot. She has state services, which is a lot. She's doing a huge amount of social housing, so that's how she can help.
How ambitious do you think Judith Collins is? Do you think she could challenge you for your job?
Well, I hope there are 58 MPs currently in the caucus that can challenge me for my job, and that's because you know I don't feel threatened by caucus. I feel invigorated by them. They're a strong team and they're good and they know what they're doing. And you know, every political party needs succession over time. But do I think she's going to come and do anything untoward to me? No, not the slightest. We've got a good working relationship. You know, she's professional about what she did. I thought she was thoroughly professional when she stood down. She's worked hard in the last 12 months and she's earned her right to come back.
Was it a slap in the face by David Seymour not to take those roles?
No, funnily enough, actually, I think it's an interesting move from David Seymour, but quite clever. I mean, he's fundamentally saying he's a young MP. He wants to dedicate himself to a cause he really believes in, euthanasia. He can't carry on that members' bill if he becomes a minister, because he can't champion that. He's got a lot of work to do in terms of the rebuild of Act. He's committed to trying to bring in more MPs in 2017. And he's got a lot of work to do in Epsom. I think he's just saying, look, he's a young man with a big future in front of him, and those opportunities will come. So I was actually slightly surprised, but actually thought it was quite clever.
But actually, this bill hasn't been drawn yet, has it?
No.
It may not be.
Well, that's right. It doesn't stop him. It doesn't stop him continuing. Okay. The issue would be if he'd taken up his ministerial post, he would have had to sign the bill, and the question would be who would take that up.
Have you made any requests of Judith Collins of how to handle herself as Minister, given some of the issues that were a bit of a lightning rod for controversy in your last term, particularly things like Horovita?
Well, naturally we've had a discussion about my expectations, because every Minister has that discussion with me, and it's quite an ongoing discussion from time to time. As I said to Judith, you know, the important issues now are about the future. Not about the past and relitigating things. And they are actually about all of us acknowledging that you know, we have experiences, and actually as politicians we make mistakes. I make plenty of them. I try not to repeat them, and I learn from them. But no one's perfect, and no one gets everything 100% right. I suspect the 12 months she's had in the back bench has given her a chance just to reflect on that a little bit more. I think it will make her stronger as a minister.
Have you requested that there be more separation between her and her husband's activities?
No, but I have, you know, she herself actually said, I think at some point when all this was going on, I got through all the transcripts, but words to the effect that said, yeah, she needs to make sure she manages, you know, those issues clearly, if you like. And again, I'm sure she's learned from that experience more than.
What percentage turnout do you think has been
I think it's travelling pretty well. I mean, just on the numbers we have at the moment, it's 1.133 million. It's tracking virtually exactly where the 2013 referendum was. I think what you'll see is you probably might see a bit bigger turnout for the second referendum, because that's going to be the one that actually really, you know, assesses whether the current New Zealand flag is retained or not. But overall, typically with postal referendums, you get a lower turnout, and this is tracking about in line with everything else.
Will you eventually vote
yet,
or
you? No, I voted, yeah.
Would it have been better to try out online voting for this referendum to get more of a turnout?
No, I don't think so. I mean, firstly, there's quite a lot of mixed evidence around online voting. Local government, I think it's been used, not New Zealand, but overseas, and I don't think it's been there. Yeah, I think initially it probably worked okay, but generally been less successful. Might be a bit cheaper, but we would have had to design the system, so there'd been a lot of systems costs. And of course, there are always issues about people getting online. Not everybody has access to that. Obviously, most people do, but not everybody does. And there are also just issues about making. You'd have to be 100% sure that you've got the accuracy of it, you know, of it right, and the authenticity of it correct. So, It's something I know that's been looked at, and Cabinet's had some discussions, local government's considering trialling it, but at their cost, but there's quite a bit of work to be done yet.
Minister, did the Cabinet have any discussions about the anti-melanoma drug key treated stuff?
No, not really, not a specific thing about that. There's been a wider discussions you'd expect. I reflected on the year in review and the sorts of issues that we face going forward, and health is a wider discussion than that, because it's a big part of what we care about. I mean, the thing I'd say with Keytruda is that, as I said this morning, I mean, I have tremendous sympathy for people that are suffering with advanced melanoma. We, for the most part, have got, I think, a very good system in New Zealand where Pharmac actually makes those decisions. I accept the kind of hypocrisy of it, and that we rode over the top of that when we funded the Cigna. I think it was actually the right call at the time. I don't think it's impossible to get Pharmac to fund Keytruda. The issue is Pharmac would say that if we give them a bit more money, there are other drugs they would see where the efficacy is higher. Not in melanoma, but in other areas. They'd say if you think you give them quite a bit more money, they definitely will fund it. So it's not a philosophical issue, it's about resources. The only other point I'd simply make is the point I was making this morning, which is Keytruda, you know, could over time prove to be somewhat of a wonder drug, very much like a sentence for one with HER2 type cells for breast cancer. The really good news part of the story is that's part of the evolution of biologics, and over the years ahead, there'll be lots more discussions about other Herceptins and other Keytrudas. The truth is that they're starting to develop some fantastic drugs now, and they're very expensive. I mean, the average development of these drugs is anywhere between $1 and $3 billion in terms of the IP, so the costs are great early on. And the only challenge for us as an economy is to continue to afford those as they come on stream to give people the opportunity to extend their life for a lot longer than we would.
But the government won't be stepping in overriding Pharmac on Keytruda.
We haven't had those discussions or tried to take those actions and do anything on that today. You know, there's been a broader discussion on that issue overall about Keytruda, and the minister, as you expect, has got advice from his officials and ultimately from Pharmac. As it currently sits, they would say there are other bigger priorities, but they're not ruling out, and we're not ruling out potentially even getting the resources to do that. I think the way to do it would be to give Pharmac more money.
And what sort of timeline would that decision be on?
I can't give you an answer to that. I don't know yet.
Well, we might take another look at early access funding from the UK.
That's all the potential advice they could get. Do you mean something where they could get it for a period of time, several weeks or 2 year funding? All those are possibilities, but again, we have to move on. Our preference would be to move on so far.
Will the government have to look at restructuring the funding of Pharmac or expanding the envelope for these biologics in the long run?
In my view, yes, because what's happening, if you think about it, is we spent about $650 million on drugs when we first became the government. Today it's $800 million. Actually, what's happening is you're seeing the development of all of these new drugs and new options. And that's the reason why people are living a lot longer. I mean, the sort of surgical procedures, the sort of drugs that are available now were never available 5, 10, 20 years ago. And it's a great thing. It extends our life and gives us all a lot more options. But the costs for the Crown are rising, and they'll continue to rise because these drugs will continue to be invented.
So are you going to have some sort of formal review or build it into the budget in the next few years?
Well, I think it's one of those things where, in part, we would say that's why it's important that we're a growing economy that's got its books back in order. Because ultimately, when you do have your books back in order, at least it gives you the choices you can make about how much additional funding you put up. I mean, health is still our number one funding item, has been the whole way through, and we've increased it every year we've been there.
Prime Minister, can I ask you quickly about the organisation SAFE, basically the advert in the Guardian about New Zealand's dairy industry. In the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom, what are your thoughts on that, on them taking that battle?
Well, I'm really disappointed in them because I think it's a form of economic sabotage. They're quite entitled to make the claims they make on the basis that they can back them up. And actually, anybody that has information about animal welfare should bring that into the public domain, and we will investigate that. We'll put more money and more resources and greater legislative support around that process. But if you were to take an ad in New Zealand, at least you could make the case you're trying to influence other lawmakers in New Zealand and the New Zealand public to take an ad in the international media for what end is that other than to try and stop international consumers buying our products? And I can't see how that's either a fair thing to do or an appropriate thing to do.
Will it hurt sales, do you reckon, over there?
It can do. I mean, image is very important. Actually, the tragedy of all that is the vast overwhelming bulk of New Zealand farmers and those involved in the agricultural sector care deeply about their animals and care deeply about animal welfare issues. I can't say that every farmer does or every person working in that industry does. I think it's like any entity where you have a large cohort of people, you can always get one or two people that let side down. But those people should be held to account and held to account very firmly. But I just do think it runs the risk that it damages us.
Prime Minister, we spoke to a group of people in Hawke's Bay this week who believe the sympathy towards Islamic State, ISIL, ISIS, is growing. What measures does the government have in place, and are more resources going into keeping an eye on this issue?
Well, there has been more both resources and more capability. We're going through a security review of our intelligence agencies and the legislation that supports them, and there has been more money going into that area, and there certainly will be in future budget bids. In terms of that there is more support for Islamic State in New Zealand, only from very sick and deluded individuals, I'm afraid, because in reality, these are people that, you know, basically murder other people, they behead other people, they throw gay people off buildings, they burn people alive. Their behaviour is barbaric. They are neither Islamic nor a state. And actually they do a massive disservice to the billions of law-abiding, good, honest Muslims around the world. So people might get very seduced by their messages and somehow believe those messages are right. And you're right, there are a small group of people that are quite in tune with those messages, but I think that they have a very perverse world order.
So what confidence can you give the New Zealand public that your government and its agencies are doing everything it can to keep this as low as possible?
Well, firstly I'd say go back and have a look at all of the debates around the GCSB legislation and the points that I made at that time, both of the need for intelligence agencies, that they needed to be part of the finalised community, that yes, they need proper oversight and greater transparency about what they were doing, that they needed better resources. All of those things have been happening. We've been strengthening both the SIS and the GCSB as organisations and strengthened the oversight considerably with the new Inspector General. No leader can stand up and say anywhere in the world they can guarantee the safety of all of their people, because as you saw in Paris, there was no early warning from what we can see about the actions that were taken there. But in so much that we are part of those organisations, we work hard to do everything we can to follow up all of those leads. We're doing everything we practically can.
There's a petition tomorrow calling for a national holiday on a day.
I think it's my understanding is that I think there's been more done on the curriculum around teaching over the last few years on that issue. I think that is really important. It's important to understand our history. Ultimately, if you were probably going to have an actual holiday, you'd have to replace it with another one. The question would be what that would be. I mean, some people would say, oh, it's not a holiday. But, you know, you'd have to. Are you talking about public holiday or are you talking about just a salary commission? You know, it's just so hard to pay. Yeah, I think.
Well,
anti-salary commission.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's public holiday, and so the point is, because actually I think it is, if they're arguing it's a public holiday, and the point would be you'd have to replace it with some other public holiday. The government's not intending to extend the number of public holidays.
The PBTA won a legal challenge to define Teach First New Zealand program as illegal. That can't be overturned with the government instead of looking at the law to...
Yeah, we'll need to review exactly what's taking place with the ERA decision. I've got to say, I find it pretty disappointing, because the program actually is aimed at getting really bright young people who have got qualifications in another area and allowing them to teach our youngsters. And I think we all know that the teacher that stands in front of our students can actually come from a variety of different backgrounds with a variety of different training and still do a fantastic job. And I think it was a good way of trying to encourage some people who had very good qualifications to consider teaching. And there's nothing more rewarding or actually arguing more important than teaching. So I'd be disappointed if those people got lost in the system.
What is the government going to focus on next year?
Well, the economy will still be a big issue next year, I think. I mean, ultimately, if you think about the big issues, I think that matters to voters, that I think they've changed the economy. Health, education, law and order are all very important. RMA reform is something we'll be pushing through. We're talking about the issues we're dealing with in terms of Maryland land reform. We've got budget 2016 that we're starting to work on the issues there. I mean, quite a bit we've been doing around both vulnerable children and ultimately areas around the way we deliver social services in the community. You know, there's still trade deals that we're trying to push along, so there's quite a lot in that agenda. What I can tell you is there's a bunch of bids about a mile long at the moment for the Minister of Finance to consider for budget 2016, and they reflect different work programs that the government would like to progress, or at least ministers would like to progress. It's pretty busy agenda next year.
Does that mean you think you'll be in surplus by the time we get to the 2017 election?
Well, the 2017, yes, I would have thought so. You have to wait and see the half year update. I think it's December 15th, but I'll have those numbers, the update, get the whole one today. So you
might dip back into deficit?
Well, you wait and see when he releases the stuff on the 15th.
Just on Rishabh, did Sam McLean's performance and corrections play any role at all in the portfolio going to Collins?
The decision that said earlier was largely based on the fact that I wanted to put the portfolios together and I thought they naturally suited her skills.
Was there any, did his performance in that portfolio play any role at all in that decision? I mean, you say largely, but that's not entirely.
Well, I don't want to go through the individual parts of the details. I mean, I think there's a lot of things he's done very well there. I mean, he's been dealing with a very difficult situation, and that's just the nature of what happens from time to time when you're the minister. You know, some things will happen under your watch that are always in your control. I mean, they sometimes happen. I mean, what I think was by far the bigger factor was ultimately Judith's capacity.
So Judith didn't come back. Sam picked up police?
You're asking kind of a pretty hypothetical because I would have still had to replace Tim. That would have depended who I replaced him with in these school sets.
When did you decide about Judith Collins?
Well, I've been aware for some period of time that it was likely that Tim would go. He got the formal tick off as a US system has to do that back when he was only when I was away overseas. My preference was to deal with the decision before the end of the year because I'd like to sort of hit the ground running next year. So I think in my own mind I kind of closed off on the issue just before I went away, but because it's been a bit of a full process for a period of time.
And were there any other factors in the decision to do it in December?
Not really. I mean, well, it's the last week of Parliament, but I don't deal with it now. I don't to deal with it in the new year. And the problem we've got is that Tim's staying in Paris to complete the climate change conference. I actually asked him if he wanted to come back and do a valedictory, because I think he's got a lot of things to reflect on in the time that he's been here. But he felt really strongly he needed to do his job properly in Paris. Ultimately, with Mike coming back, we really need to send out a new ambassador. And if we did it all in the new year, it gets really messy because I'd fundamentally have to probably do it sometime in February. It was just a long time, really. So this seems the right time.
What are going to be his priority? What are Tim Gross's priorities going to be? I mean, is it all going to be about TPP or the other things?
No, I mean, the role of New Zealand ambassador in Washington is a wide and diverse one. I mean, it's about New Zealand's interests, of which trade is just one of them. But we have a very broad relationship, everything from, our work in the Five Eyes together to, everything that from the New Zealand-US partnership forum, there's a bunch of things we do. It's, our prized ambassadorial post, so you'll have a lot of work to do.
You said the same before you ended up with a very difficult
decision. As you would expect, I have a group of very senior ministers that I have a high trust relationship with, and I have discussions with them, and I let them know my thinking. I'm not going to detail all the discussions we had because it wouldn't be appropriate for me to do that, but I don't sort of live in a vacuum, and but I tend to make decisions solely on my own. I might come to a view, but I always try and share those with my colleagues.
You said that Sam was being dealt with a difficult situation in corrections. Do you think he dealt with it well?
Yeah, I do for the most part, actually. I mean, it's just that all these things are very difficult. I mean, every minister, you know, in a big portfolio from time to time, can just have things that happen. I mean, I had, you know, GCSB when Kim.com was the legal spider. I didn't actually do anything to make that happen, and I wasn't aware of it, but it happened, and I had to deal with all the things that happened after that. In the end, ultimately, that's just the nature of being a minister.
If he'd excelled, though, he would have helped onto that portfolio.
No, I don't think that's right. Yeah, it suited the sort of portfolios I wanted to put truth into. Okay.